Well, Gary, there's been a lot of things on my mind recently, and I think probably the most important of which that I've been contemplating is how do we go about, I guess, taking the initiative to restore our government? I mean, for instance, I mean, what grievances in the 1776 Declaration of Independence correlate with those grievances we have today in 2014?
Well, there were 27 grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence, and a while back I went through them to see how many are applicable, at least to some degree, today. First is he has refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. And what comes to mind immediately on that one is we have a law against illegal entry into this country. But the government, the executive branch, the enforcer of that law, which in a sense is the king, because basically some of the founders thought that we compared with the government created by the Constitution as a similar to England, except our monarch was elected, and in a sense that's it. The monarch is the one that controls the execution of the laws, and so the monarch here now is not enforcing that law and many other laws that should be enforced. They were enacted by the legislatures for a purpose. Now, they say he refuses to assent to the laws. The difference here is he didn't veto the laws. He just doesn't enforce them. They're on the books. So it is quite similar. Next, he has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation until he assents, until his assent should be attained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. Well, our structure is a little bit different, but let's look at it this way, that the judicial branch of government, they called it the King's Bench in England, he had a substantial influence over the judicial branch of government. And our judiciary is turning laws that are turned over back on us, saying, no, that doesn't work. A federal court, for example, in Texas recently said that turned down the Texas voter ID law. Now, the appellate court wisely restored the ID law. Many states, through the Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, guaranteeing every right, a state guaranteeing every state a republican form of government, have in their constitution adopted a definition of marriage, saying a marriage is between a man and a woman. A federal district judge, a minion of the judicial system, is able to overturn those state laws, and the Supreme Court has just recently refused to hear those challenges to the overturning. Now, interestingly, another appellate judge overturned two states, Idaho and Nevada, I think, said they did not have to start issuing queer marriage licenses while it's pending going to the Supreme Court. But so the laws that are passed by the people, the Republican form of government, are being ignored by the federal government or overturned by the federal government or by a lowly district court judge or a lowly appellate court. Three, he has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for the purpose of obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migration hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. Well, now here we're dealing with naturalization of foreigners. He says then they were obstructing. They're doing just the opposite now, but it's so similar. He assumes an absolute authority, regardless of the enactments of Congress, on whether people could be naturalized or not. The conversation now is, he's going to grant, and the probability is he's going to grant amnesty to people who have entered this country illegally after the elections. after the elections because he doesn't want the Democratic Party to lose any more than they're going to lose at this next election. We're in October now. The elections are just a couple of weeks away. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing to assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. Well, he has effectively kept state courts from exercising their proper jurisdiction. There was a case in, I believe it was Utah, where the Utah Supreme Court says we can't even enforce our own constitution because of federal judicial decisions. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Well, the one that first comes to mind in this is called the Internal Revenue Service. But wait, we've got the BLM, we've got the BATF, we've got the DEA, we've got the Park Service that are armed, and they swarm and they eat out our substance, because if you're charged with a crime, it will cost you a fortune to defend yourself, so you end up doing a plea agreement.
You're referring to the administrative agencies, right?
Well, yes, they're administrative agencies. They're the extension of the executive branch of government, but they're well beyond the intention of the framers. But they are the multitude of new offices. I've got on my computer somewhere a list of federal agencies, and there's over 1,500 federal agencies. Now, some are little ones, subordinate to bigger ones, subordinate to bigger ones, subordinate to bigger ones, up to the cabinet position that's over it. For example, DHS. A lot of things were transferred to DHS. So we got FBI, ATF, DEA. I don't know how many are under that now. And then within those agencies, they can have sub-agencies. But at that point, and giveaway programs, I'm not sure which, I guess health, education, and welfare has got a phenomenal spread of lower level, three or four tiers down agencies to give our money to people who aren't willing to earn their money. So that was really a kicker. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies without the consent of our legislature. Now, we're not going to talk about state and local police. We're going to talk about the federal government. It was about 1932 when the first internal federal agency, with the exception of, I think, the Secret Service, was given permission to use firearms. It was during the Prohibition, and it was the FBI. And ironically, within 2 weeks, the first FBI agent was killed by gunfire. But now we've armed the National Park Service, BLM, Bureau of Land Management. They need guns to manage that land. There might be a vicious tortoise attack them, or somebody's rustled cattle or something like that. But the arming of administrative agencies has just gone out of hand, and in a sense, this is a circumvention of the prohibition against a standing army. Having a military force, we've always had one. In the Western frontier, there were thousands of soldiers, cavalry and infantry. I mean, in the movies, it's all cavalry, but they had cavalry and infantry to protect the border, but they didn't do anything internally within the states or within the territories that had already had their the executive legislation, legislative and judicial established, except for incursions by Indians. But standing army, the objection was when the Redcoats were in Boston, for example, they were armed. They were a standing army. They could push people around, and Boston Massacre was demonstrative of that. But now we've got Boston Tea Parties occurring all the time. The only difference is the King's forces never stand trial. They just kill somebody, get time off with pay, and are investigated by their own agency and cleared of any wrongdoing, and then go back to work and continue gaining their retirement, working towards their retirement. Next, he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and acknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts or pretend legislation. Now, the federal government has made no objection to local courts, and there have been some federal courts that were early on in this game, have not imposed judicial prohibitions against the implementation of Sharia law. And that is a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution, without question. Those are biblical laws. If we use the Old Testament, a man that sleepeth with another man as if he were a woman would be stoned to death. We don't do that. We don't apply biblical laws from the Christian or Judeo-Christian religions or Jewish, because of the same Old Testament. We don't apply those nowadays. But the Muslims do. And they're getting away with it, and they have the consent of the executive branch of government by those same courts that will say, you can't say marriage, 2,000-year-old or 3,000-year-old exercise between a man and a woman, has to be between a man and woman, but they will not involve themselves when a man cuts his daughter's head off because she used a cell phone, or dated somebody, an infidel. The next one, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. Well, the one before last, we were talking about the troops that are armed and quartered among us. All these administrative agencies. So we're doubling up on that one, I guess. For protecting them, meaning armed troops, by mock trial from punishment for any murders they shall commit on the inhabitants of these states. Well, we don't even have mock trials. We have administrative hearings that find no wrongdoing. They don't even go to trial. There's no judgment by a judge or a court. All the judgment is determined by the supervisors, the people that give them the orders to go out and do things. So if I tell somebody under me to go out and kill that guy, and then public finds out that he killed that guy, then it goes back to me to decide if he committed a crime or not. And if he testified and said he told me to do it, then I'm going to be in trouble. So that's justifiable homicide. And that's where we are. I mean, we're so similar to what happened back then. For imposing taxes upon us without our consent. Now, we assume to have consent, but at least five states in the constitutional conventions where the states ratified the Constitution, they were told that direct taxes will only be upon the people. Will only be applied during an emergency, after a war. They had to pay off the war debt. They could have imposed a personal direct tax after the Revolutionary War to pay off the debt, but instead they didn't. The next one occurred during the Civil War, and then we didn't have any more until 1913 with the 16th Amendment. But those taxes are supposed to be only in an emergency, but they were applied initially to gain and now to all that comes in, and they keep escalating in their impact on us. And some people are paying, well, between state and local taxes, many people are paying between 40 and 60% of what they earn to taxes, not counting. If I buy something that's made by Joe Smith, Joe Smith has to pay taxes. So I've got to pay enough in the labor cost of that product to cover Joe Smith's taxes. So if we look at all the taxes that are paid from raw material to production and through sales, all the people along that entire chain of production, we could be paying 90-95% in taxes. And the government takes this money, spends it frivolously, prints more, and then we get inflation so that the money that we earned is diminished in its purchasing power, as if the government doesn't have enough money by stealing all our money to begin with. So, I would say that was without our consent. Now, the consent back then was presumed to be representatives of our choice. But look at the representatives. Have they ever questioned the income tax? Well, a few have, and some of them have ended up in prison for doing what other congressmen do, but they were turned out for doing it.
Yeah, George Hansen comes to mind.
Yeah, George Hansen is one. There's one that died just recently. What was his name? An Italian name. I wrote an article about him years ago, but he was one. So he and Hansen are two good examples. But is it with our consent? You know, I wrote an article a while back about what happens when you turn Congress over to the market, or submit Congress to the market forces, and it goes into that to replenish their election campaigns, re-election campaigns, they sell laws that will benefit one person over another. So it's not with our consent, it's with their consent. It has nothing to do with us. It has to do with them having a marketable commodity called their vote and their influence and marketing that at our expense. Next, for depriving us in many cases of the benefit of a trial by jury. Well, we always have the option of a trial by jury, but trials by jury have gotten extremely expensive. And so we have come to a time in our history where most cases, even if the person is not guilty, when they look at the consequences of fighting in court to defend their innocence, if the other side will come down low enough, they will plea bargain their way out. Or they will submit to be turned an informant to avoid prosecution. So the benefits of a trial by jury have become unbelievably expensive. Oh, well, you can always take a public defender, and these guys just get X dollars for your case, and they probably can't find another job lawyering anywhere. But, hey, you've got representation. It doesn't matter that the guy's a blooming idiot. For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government. Yes, the fundamental form of government, Article 4, Section 4, guaranteeing all states a republican form of government. But they are taking away our constitutions. If we amend the Constitution on queer marriages, they will unamend the Constitution on queer marriages, prohibiting queer marriages. They have abolished existing laws on the books in favor of what they want. And a good example that, let me find it real quick. There's one in here that says no state, no state shall impair the obligation of contracts. Now, I don't know if that means the federal government or not, but the state can't. Now, a real estate transaction is a state matter. The federal government's not involved in a real estate transaction. And when I was young, they had covenants and restrictions. They still do, but they're limited in what they can do with them now. But they had covenants and restrictions. I was raised in Southern California, and there are quite a few areas where the covenants and restrictions, when the land was subdivided and split from the original owner, he put covenants and restrictions in. Those covenants and restrictions were given to the buyer. He read and understood them. Now, it's a civil matter. It's a contract. And, for example, they would say something like that this property shall never be sold to somebody of the Negro persuasion. Well, during the civil rights era, the federal government overrode the prohibition about impairing the right of contract. So they have abolished our laws. They have decided in many instances what the states can and can't do. They basically abolish a law by a district court, an appellate court, or a Supreme Court decision. The idea behind the United States, which used to be these United States, plural, There were a bunch of them. Now there's one, and we've accepted the premise that the United States is a singular entity. Because the states have become non-entities. They appear to have authority, but the federal government will remove authorities that have existed for over a century within a state at the whim of the federal government. So they are altering fundamentally the forms of our government. For suspending our legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Well, they haven't suspended the legislatures. However, they have, by chicanery, really, have assumed the authority to legislate in what would be the purview of our state legislatures, along the lines of what I was just talking about, where the legislatures really can't touch an issue for various reasons. One, the federal government's presumed authority, and one thing behind that quite often that keeps the state from opposing the federal government is the fact that the federal government is giving them money for something, the green mail, and if they don't go along with what the federal government wants to do as far as changing the source of power in legislative areas, they'll withhold the funds to the state. And this is why back in the 90s and more recently, states have talked about state sovereignty. We've got the 10th Amendment centers for assisting to take states retain their sovereignty or regain their sovereignty. And it ain't going to happen because the states then will lose the revenue that binds them to obedience to certain aspects of the federal government. Good example is schools. If schools don't go along with what the federal government wants, they'll withhold funding. Schools are a state or a county or a local school district entity, but the federal government dictates curriculum, dictates rules, and according to Michelle Obama, can even dictate what you can put in your mouth while you're on the school grounds. So, every time I get into this, I get this way. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. Well, who are these armed guys coming across the border in the south? Cartels? Mexican army? They've documented intrusion by Mexican army, armed and even shooting at. In one case, they shot an American citizen on our side of the border. So he has abdicated our government and declared us out of his protection in the border zones. And right now, one of the units working on the border is getting pressure. The BPS and local sheriff are going to ranchers that have given these people permission to go on their land and intimidated and put fear in the landowner saying, oh, look, if anything happens, you will be liable for what happens on your property. So one of these units has had two property owners withdraw their agreement to allow them on their property. They want exclusive control so they can allow these fast and furious weapons to come back into this country to kill people. They were doing the same thing when they let these fast and furious weapons go out of this country in the first place. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete his work of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. Well, this one might be a stretch, but then it might not. He hasn't transported large armies. They were talking about the Hessians back then. He hasn't transported large body armies, but he has created them within our boundaries, and many of them, in fact, the military is going to begin taking undocumented people as military enlistees. So, yeah, I guess we could apply that one. We've just got to convert it to modern times. And finally, He has excited domestic insurrection amongst us and has endeavored to bring the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Oh, I said Indians. What comes to mind was Trayvon Martin in Ferguson, Missouri, where the federal government seems to be inciting illegal activity resulting in death in Missouri, where a number of people have died, by ignoring the laws that exist and without attempting to maintain the peace within the communities.
Speaking
so that's where we were 238 years ago.
Wow. Well, speaking of incitement, isn't it illegal for us to simply talk about violently resisting the government? Wouldn't they consider it to be sedition, incitement, or even treasonous, especially considering the Brandenburg versus Ohio case?
Well, let me back up just a second. When I was talking about the Declaration of Independence, I want to explain something that from a political philosophy, and this goes back to the 15th century, 16th century, somewhere back there. The Declaration of Independence was, in fact, a declaration of dissolution of government. Now, I have written a recent one. It's not as broad as what we just discussed, but I think we'll make sure that we have a link posted for the Declaration of Dissolution of Government. And you'll see a form similar to independence. The thing is, we don't want independence now. We want to dissolve the government created by the Constitution that had stepped out of its confines and restore a government that sticks within the limitations imposed upon it by the Constitution. Okay, now your question, Brandenburg versus Ohio is an interesting case. It's 395 U.S. 444, and it was determined in 1969. And it had to do with the Ku Klux Klan. And the question was, if there's incitement in a speech to do deeds, if there's no specificity to those deeds, there's no crime, because that comes under freedom of speech. So yes, we can speak like this, as long as we're not specific in directing, you know, the general, go do this to them now. That would be specific. To talk about theoretical or philosophical, or which we will be doing in this conversation, that's protected by freedom of speech. The United States Supreme Court so said 45 years ago. So, but we also have a government document that tells us the same thing, the first government document, the one that created a concept called the United States of America. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide for new guards for their future security. And that is where we are, and that is protected by our history books as well as the Brandenburg versus Ohio case.
Now, some pundits have alleged that we are revolutionaries. Would it be more accurate to say that we don't advocate revolution, but rather the collective defense of the United States Constitution?
I think appropriately. A revolution is one that wants to turn out the old government and install a new government. And, you know, that was addressed in the Declaration of Independence to some degree, but there's matters of degree. They also said alter or abolish. Abolish would be revolution. Alter would approach revolution. But wait, we have a constitution. And I like that constitution. The government doesn't like it, but I like it. So are we revolutionaries? No. We're advocates of restoration of constitutional government. Let's get back to the rule of law for government, because they expect us to abide by the rule of law that they make or don't make, or not abide by the rule of law if they don't like it, for us not to abide by the rule of law. The border issue, for example, the Department of Homeland Security is now delegated the responsibility of keeping people from illegally entering the country, but they don't. And so the people down on the border, some of them are, do we lose the right to protect our borders? No, they're going to assume the role of government in terms of turning those people back to the government. So what we're trying to do is get back to where we're supposed to be in the first place. This loss has gone over a very long period of time. How do we get it back? I wrote an article, The Constitution is Not a Suicide Pact. Was that document written so that the legislature could undermine the intent of that document? Is it possible that when they wrote that, they had in mind that we want this to be able to be subverted without using the amendment process? No. It's not that way. So what we want to do, as I said, is restore constitutional government. It's not a revolution. It's a restoration.
Okay. Well, since I guess you could say we're restorationists, then does what we are talking about therefore require the consent of the governed?
Did the Founding Fathers seek the consent of the governed by the Crown to achieve what they achieved? Well, there were enough that gave their consent to the change. Let me put it that way. There's an article that I wrote many years ago called Sons of Liberty 14. And it talks about what the right of the people is. Does it require a majority? Does it require the consent of all the people? Or does it require the consent of those that are willing to take the risk of the consequences should they fail to achieve the abolishment or the amending or the return of government to what it should be? So no, it doesn't take the consent during the revolutionary period. Very possibly, as much by the end of the Revolutionary War, as much as half the people or more supported the cause. But when it began, it was what, 80 some people in Lexington Green. Within a few hours, it was a few hundred people. But New York, Albany, New York said, hey, that's their problem down there in Massachusetts. We're not going to do anything about it. So Albany, New York had not given their consent. But people from Rhode Island and other parts of New York and Connecticut were on their way to Massachusetts at the same time. So the consent can begin with a few willing to stand, and it can grow proportionally with the number of people that see that it's a just cause that they're getting involved with and then giving their consent to.
Well, kind of switching gears more towards methodology, is there a difference between civil disobedience and restoring constitutional government?
Yeah, civil disobedience is a lowly step on the ladder to restoring a constitutional government. Civil disobedience is disobeying the law and facing the risk of being incarcerated or perhaps even fined for not obeying the law. There's a meme going around the internet now that has a picture of a guy on a horse with a flag at the Bundy Ranch. And it says, civil disobedience, the American way of life, or something to that effect. Well, I've commented on a few of those, and I've said, no, this is not that. What happened at the Bundy Ranch was not civil disobedience. That was civil defiance. So the next step after civil obedience is civil defiance. That was standing on Lexington Green and saying, no, you're not going to go by here. That was the people surrounding Concord and then coming down on the British troops. They were defying the British authority to be in Concord. That's defiance. So that's the next step. The ultimate goal was the creation of the Constitution, and as in our case, the ultimate goal is the restoration of both state and federal constitutions to what was originally intended without the arbitrary influence of the federal government. Now, regarding that subject, putting another perspective on that, civil disobedience is minor infractions. Restoration of constitutional government is major usurpation of the authority of the government to rule outside the Constitution. And so with regard to that, there were links to which Constitution am I protected by, which sets the distinction between the state and the federal Constitution. And then there's another one called the Three Constitutions, because right now in this country, not counting the state constitution, the federal constitution, we have three of them. And very briefly, there is the one that the chief law enforcement officer, the sheriff, the chief of police, or somebody tells his people they can do and get away with. He tells them it's constitutional, and they believe him. Or maybe he doesn't tell them it's constitutional, but they believe it's constitutional. The next one that, as a consequence of those unconstitutional acts by street people, this is just one thread of the revision of the Constitution, but they commit acts like not telling the Miranda, not telling people they have rights. Now everybody knows, but they still got to do Miranda, but then they'll lie, cheat, and steal on that, which they did to Beecher. So the second constitution then is when these illegal unconstitutional acts, searches of cars without a warrant, searches of houses without a warrant, when they get to the higher courts and ultimately the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court says, well, in some cases we might want to allow this. This is a blatant violation of the Constitution, but we might allow it because for the safety of the officers or for whatever reason, they will then amend the intent of the Constitution. So let's call that Constitution number two. That's the Constitution that the Supreme Court has given us. And then Constitution number three, well, that's the one that was written a couple hundred years ago in very plain language that any of us can understand. If you have a problem with the word, look up the word. What does infringe mean? Shall not be infringed. It means don't even, a fringe is a tasseling of the edge. Don't even infringe that. Don't even put little strings on that thing to change it from what it is. The Second Amendment shall not be infringed. So easily understood. Never said anything about hunting. Had those people on Lexington Green had only the rifles the government allowed them, the best they would have had would be cheap little blunderbuss-type bird rifles, the kind of a quasi-shotgun. The government had outlawed, and it was going to Concord to seize rifles that could be, not rifles, but guns, long arms, that could be used against the British. They weren't allowed by law to have what the British had, which was primarily the Brown Besses then. So Did the Constitution, the Second Amendment, for example, want to put us back where the British wanted us when Lexington Green occurred? No, they didn't. They wanted us to be equal to or better than the British at that point in time because they knew that government could get out of hand. But we've got the Supreme Court in many decisions saying, well, that's not quite true. You can't have automatic weapons. You can't do this. You can't do that. So that's the third Constitution is one the founders gave us. It is our birthright. That's it. That's all there is to it. It's ours, and it cannot be messed with.
One thing I keep hearing from those who advocate for peaceful evolution, who want to engage in what some have called nonviolent non-cooperation, is that they assume that the perceived, as they would describe it, the perceived disparity of force between government entities and the people in common is a fait accompli. So I guess my next question is, are not citizens outgunned by professional militaries?
Well, outgunned is kind of an interesting term. Does it mean more guns or bigger guns or faster guns or bigger bore guns? What does it mean? Let's go back to what we just talked about. These guys with basically bird rifles and hunting rifles took on people with military rifles. Some did have military rifles that had been taken from the British, and as time went on, more and more military rifles came into our camp. They were outgunned at Bunker Hill, but it was a victory. But one thing that occurred during the Revolutionary War that is pretty impressive is that the guns often don't matter as much as the tactics. The tactics that were employed, and I think the most beautiful example, and is one worth reading about, was called Cowpens. That they outsmarted the British on many occasions. Sometimes they got outsmarted, sometimes they did stupid things. But for the most part, you can be outgunned and prevail. So it's fear-mongering to say we're outgunned. It's not wise to assume that we can be outsmarted, because my experience in dealing with the federal government is there's a lot of them that ain't very smart. So I think that we can outsmart them regardless of what we have, and in the exercise of outsmarting them, we can increase our firepower.
On that same line of thought, why should patriots study military strategy and tactics?
How to put this? My son plays baseball. And baseball has, if my wife listens to all these commentaries on baseball games. She watches all the baseball games. And there are some of the old players who are talking now about all the injuries that occur in baseball now. They didn't used to happen. And one of the big differences between back then and now is they've gotten into strength training as a way of building up. In fact, one commercial for one car manufacturer, this guy goes and does his strength. He strikes out. He goes and does his strength training, comes back and hits a home run, and then they promote the car. Strength training is a focused exercise. So I've strengthened my muscles in all the linear aspects that I've done the exercises in. Curling, I don't know what they call these exercises. But what about these little subtle movements outside of that main course? Well, that's where they get the injuries, when they go from the strengthened motions to the unstrengthened motions, or vice versa. By the same token, military tactics, if you take them too much to heart, trap you. That's exactly what happened to the British quite often. The first one really was Bunker Hill. They followed the military tactics of the day, and they got slaughtered. Cowpens again, and a number of other battles where the British fought with the trained tactics. Now, we have a lot of ex-military people that say, well, the militias need to be led by somebody with experience. And most of these guys, there might be some officers, might be some NCOs, might be some just buck sergeants or even corporals, but they assume their experience in knocking down doors. They're taught police tactics, not military tactics nowadays. But if that thread of what's being taught in the military is the best tool that we have, that's absolutely wrong. It's thinking out of the box. It's thinking how to deceive the enemy, how to entrap the enemy is far more important than tactics. They can play a role as far as fundamentals. But if they're relied on too heavily, just like the strength training, they can be quite destructive because there's no element of surprise. So Resistance to Tyranny is an excellent book in talking both about tactics and about non-tactics. When I first read it, my belief was that every militia bookshelf, every committee of safety bookshelf should have two copies of this book so people could check them out and read it and get an idea of, one, what normal tactics are, and two, how to get around those normal tactics, how to defeat the enemy by a kind of a mental jujitsu, by defeating them, by turning their own practice or tactic against them. And that's exactly what Cowpens was. Resistance to Tyranny, an excellent book. Everybody should have it.
Now, many people within the Patriot community insist that there must be an individual who is former military who would presumably direct actions on the ground. My question to you is this proper?
Well, I guess I kind of touched on that. There's two things. There's strategy and tactics. Strategy's the senior. This is, we've got a big objective here, and we've got to deal with this, and our objective is to kick their ass. Tactics, though, are assigned, then that strategy causes the assignment of various units for various, to conduct various elements of this overall strategy. Tactic is how that unit applies itself in achieving its portion of the objective. It doesn't hurt to have that background within access of whoever's in command of a unit, but it does hurt to put them in absolute control because they're going to think too much in the box. So, no, it's not proper. It's an asset to have somebody with that experience as part of a command team. One way of, you know, in the plan for militia response, we talk about command teams. As long as absolute authority isn't given to somebody with that boxed-in military experience, it's an asset. If he's given absolute authority over a squad, a platoon, or a company, it may be disastrous. So it's an asset if properly used. Now, okay, well, let me see, there's two articles I wrote then that kind of talk about during the Bundy affair, there were a couple of articles I wrote, Oath Keepers versus Militia Parts 1 and 2. And they kind of address that to some degree, that the rigidity versus flexibility, and bravery versus cowardice, that kind of address the issue. Okay.
Well, in that case, then, what is guerrilla warfare?
Well, guerrilla warfare is non-conventional tactics. It's the same thing, depending, again, on the creativity and the imagination, the strategy. The tactics are some that defeat the enemy, sometimes quite the underdog. The punji stakes of Vietnam, for example, or the various swing traps in Vietnam. A lot of tactics were used using local materials to damage the greatest military force in the world. I don't know how else to put it. And they, again, that proves the ability to circumvent that power by thinking. World War II, the guerrillas, in, especially in France, but in some of the Scandinavian countries against the Russians, were extremely effective in the Slovakian and the Scandinavian countries were extremely effective against the German might and later the Russian might by guerrilla warfare, which is completely unconventional. You just you decide what you want to do, and you understand is what you can about what they're doing and what they might do if you do something, and then you figure a way to get around to avoid these obstacles, hopefully, throughout. So guerrilla warfare is just really non-conventional warfare. Do what needs to be done, but it does defy the concept of too much on military strategy.
What are some examples of guerrilla operations then?
Well, specific examples. Well, I can think of one in the Revolutionary War. Some soldiers, and some patriots, militia members, and I think one of them was Paul Revere, went up to Fort William and Mary and basically walked in, then turned around and took over Fort William and Mary, seizing the cannon and powder and shot from that camp. That's guerrilla warfare. They just walked in, sauntered in off the street. I don't know. It's hard to think of some specifics, but I'm sure that people in their reflection on what they've read, or even, you know, sometimes in movies there are good examples of guerrilla operations, but they are just doing the unexpected to gain an advantage.
Okay, well then, remind me again, what is a security team?
Well, Louis Beam wrote Leaderless Resistance, and I wrote Our Security Team. They're not much difference, except Leaderless Resistance, that team is put together with a military intent. They intend to fight. It's not leaderless. It's got no external ties to leadership. In the plan we talk about in part one, where individual groups do things. Now, once they start working with other groups, then a leadership evolves outside of the cell. And I guess Louis Beam's cell is the proper term that for what Louis Beam's talking about. There is leadership within the cell. It may be a shared command. It may be just one individual. But there is leadership within it, because you can't function without leadership. Every guy can't just, I'm going to go do this. You're going to go do that? Okay. Well, we'll meet on the other side. The security team we put together back in 1992 was not intended for military purposes, though we contemplated that it could be adapted quite quickly and actually grow for military purposes. But we were looking at something that afforded protection to the members of the security team. We ended up hiding three people from the FBI until one left and went back to California, leaving the other two there. The FBI still couldn't figure it out. Finally, one turned himself in and left the other, his son, with some patriots, but then he told the FBI where the patriots were, where the son was, and they came and got the son. But we effectively held these people away from the FBI, hid them from the FBI effectively for a long period of time. There were other things that we accomplished during that period of time, but that was kind of a self-contained defensive militia. Our purpose was to protect our group. So if you have Louis Beam's cell, leaderlessly resistant cell, or have a security team, they're pretty similar, except the one has a singular purpose that's not aggressive, though it can convert to an aggressive purpose right away. The other one's primary purpose is aggressive, although it's also defensive because they're going to protect their own. So they're nearly identical in that respect.
wait a minute, how cohesive can a unit be without a chain of command?
Well, some people aren't going to like this example, but there have been groups that intended to fund their operations by robbing banks. Hey, that's an operation that they completed without any external chain of command. In the Plan for Restoration of Constitutional Government, for example, I talk about targeting. But when you're targeting somebody, if you've got a one or two or a two or three man operation, some people said, well, you have to have a jury first. Well, if we have a jury and we go to the jury and say we think this guy should be targeted, every member of the jury now knows that we intend to target this guy. So if we get caught and they find out this jury or even an individual or a couple people helped us to determine the justification of the target, they are guilty of murder if we killed the guy. So when they're charged with murder and I wasn't there, I didn't pull the trigger, well, you're still culpable in the murder because you were involved in this thing. Oh, well, wait, can I turn against them and plea bargain my way out of this? Yes. So that chain of command in any way, shape, or form at the early levels of activation of forceful restoration of government creates a risk to anybody that doesn't take an equal risk with as those within the cell or the security team. So you can't have a chain of command until things grow to the point that you're aware of another group that's operating and now you join forces with them. I can take on a bigger activity than I could before, especially if I get a third and fourth teams in on this. But somehow then we've got to have target selection. We've got to have the strategy laid out and then give the tactical decisions to each of the elements of that. Now, at that point, we've established a chain of command. As that broadens, well, squad, platoon, company, battalion, you know, as it grows, so groweth the chain of command. So the chain of command in the type of activities that, let's call them guerrilla, would grow as the ability to be productive in pursuit of the objectives grew, joining various and diverse groups together for larger and well-coordinated objectives. So the chain of command is a consequence of the success of operating without a chain of command. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Okay. Every scholar of guerrilla warfare theory understands that the guerrillas must have the support of the domestic population in order to even have a chance at a successful resolution. So what is the role of the non-fighting population?
Well, I think we have to begin with a concept that we've heard of since the 60s called the hearts and minds. But before we go there, let's go to a movie called Red Dawn. Probably most people have seen it. If not, hey, look it up. It's kind of exciting, you know, but it's got some things in there that really demonstrate the problem with the concept of hearts and minds. The parents generally are put in concentration camps or camps. The children, though, manage to get away and start taking on the enemy. Who is the enemy? It's the Russians that have come in here. They're foreign invaders. Now, where we get mixed up in this whole concept is we assumed in Vietnam that us Americans coming over to their country and helping them the way we want to help them, hey, we'll force democracy down your throat at the point of a bayonet, that we could get their hearts and minds to go with us. But back to Red Dawn. Was it possible for any of these people, except some really cowardly sorts, to ever side with the Russians? Likewise, there were some Vietnamese that, for whatever reason, sided with us. But the strength and fortitude of those people crumbled the day we left. It crumbled. It fell apart. There are pictures of uniforms just being thrown down the road. I guess these guys were running around in their shorts. They threw their uniforms, their boots, their rifles, and everything down and took off, melding back into the civilian population. Iraq, Afghanistan, hearts and minds, did they work? Hell no, they didn't work. In fact, in trying to get hearts and minds and bombing weddings and parties, we've actually disenfranchised ourselves even further from any possibility of getting the hearts and minds of those people. But wait, what about the United States? Can we get the hearts and minds of people if we are not a foreign invader, but only a competing element saying we want the Constitution back and they have abused the Constitution? Yes, if we treat them properly, if we make sure they have food, water, electricity, all the things they need, we will definitely have the hearts and minds of American people. You cannot be an invading army and even begin to expect hearts and minds. That's a military strategy. The government implemented it in the 60s, and they've continued to fail to 50 years later in trying to attract the hearts and minds. But we can, in this country, attract the hearts and minds of the non-fighting population. Now, what role do they serve? Well, initially, they'll hide people out, feed them, provide whatever support they can without creating too much risk for themselves. But as the elements grow that are fighting against de facto government, more and more, as in the revolution, more and more people are more and more willing to come on board philosophically once they know they're protected. So in the simplified explanation of the plan, I talk about white dots. If I'm on the edge of that white dot, I'm going to be reluctant to offer too much support. But as that white dot grows and totally encompasses where I am, I'm going to be more willing to do even more with the forces that are trying to return to constitutional government. So that role of non-fighting population could include growing food, all kinds of things, maintenance of vehicles, everything as it grows, and the hearts and minds are bought. But the hearts and minds are bought only by first offering them something that they need, food, water, making sure that the flow of food and water, utilities, things goes to them. And then they will do like as they do in any society. Who knows? You might find a machinist that can repair your rifles. You might find, electronics people that can build devices that you want, like something that'll fry a camera or allow you to take control of a drone. All kinds of things can happen when you get this non-fighting population on your side, the hearts and minds. So the role varies with their abilities and your ability to influence them that they're on the winning side when they join you.
To continue on that similar vein, would it be beneficial to distract the enemy?
Oh, hell yes. we're going to get into that in a little more detail in a few minutes. But yes, to distract the enemy. If the enemy thinks you're going to do this and you're going to do that, that's wonderful. You know, I've always got a kick out of real-life events, especially when I live near large population areas where there's an accident or a shooting, and 316 cop cars show up on that corner. Well, if there's a bank on the other side of town and I want to rob the bank, they have just picked the time and the place for me. The time is now. The place is across town because all the cops are over here. Can you create distractions by the same token? Yes, you can create distractions. There are any number of ways, and like I say, we'll go into that in a few minutes as far as some of the methods of creating distractions. But the most important thing in all of this is think. Figure out what you want to do, and then figure out what you can do to achieve that goal. And distraction is a great one. I'll give you some... It's actually decoy, not distraction, but it's kind of interesting. I found out during the, I think it was the Bosnian War, Or was it Kosovo? Maybe it was Kosovo. Anyway, we were going in bombing everything, and we were concerned that they had some heavy artillery and all this. And they used a tactic. We're too smart for this now. In World War II, when I was in the Army, I was an aerial photogrammetrist. As part of military intelligence, we looked at aerial images and identified the equipment below us. But we understood back then decoys, which are distractions. That's a stationary distraction opposed to, say, a moving distraction. But we knew about them. But we have gotten so ingrained in tactic and strategy and tactic now, the way they teach it in the military, that I don't know if they still have the TMs about it, but I don't know if they really talk about it much. But it came out that we were using some very expensive bombs to blow up logs. What they would do is they would take some wood and a log. They'd paint the log black, stick the barrel of the log out of the trees just a little bit, enough to be identifiable from the air. They would use some wood to maybe make what appeared to be the shield on the artillery piece, maybe painted gray, and then they would just walk away from that. They'd leave it there, and sooner or later some pilot would fly by and he'd look down and he'd say, base, I got a target of opportunity. I've got an artillery piece here, permission to drop a bomb on it, permission granted. So he drops $80,000 worth of bomb on a log. That's a distraction too, because you've taken him away from where the real artillery is further back in the trees, and you've also caused him to waste a bomb that he no longer has on his plane during that flight. Anything that distracts the enemy has got to be good.
I've heard that if you go into combat, you should act as if you were already dead. Is this true?
Well, I wasn't in, you know, face-to-face combat for an extended period like some people were. We were under fire a number of times. But I understand the concept, and so let me try and explain it. If I assume that I'm dead, then I'm not so concerned with protecting my life, rather I'm obsessed with killing the enemy. So I'm assuming I'm dead. I'm just going to kill those motherfuckers until I'm dead. Pardon my language. On the other hand, if I don't assume I'm dead, I don't want to get killed. I think I'll cower down here. And eventually somebody comes up and pokes you with a bayonet. You have lost your will to fight if you have begun to concentrate on staying alive. So it's kind of an interesting concept, but I, quite frankly, I believe that it is absolutely valid. I remember the times that I was scared in Vietnam, and they were all after action. Well, not all of them. One of them, I didn't have my boots on. Once I got my boots on, I still didn't have my pants on, but I wasn't scared once I got my boots on. Another time, a cringe of fear came over me when I found out that some tracer bullets had gone just over my head when I was crossing a bridge. So I guess I kind of didn't fear for my life over there. I don't recall ever fearing for my life, but I did feel fear. So I've got to say that from a mental standpoint, I accepted either that I was dead or that I was never going to die there. And I can't really say which. But that state of mind allowed me to respond rapidly any time any risk was created, rather than cower.
What extent of education is needed before one involves himself in the kinds of activities that would involve restoration of constitutional government?
I wrote an article called The Other Not-So-Thin Line, and it, you know, there's all kinds of people that have made observations of the Patriot community, but I don't know if anybody's put it in the same perspective that I tried to in that article, and so let me briefly explain it. There's a line that goes from left to right. It has nothing to do with political philosophy, liberal and conservative. It's just, you know, it has to have a direction. It could go up and down, but I use left and right. When people enter the Patriot community for whatever reason, they enter on the left side of the line. My involvement began in 1981 when I started dealing with the Internal Revenue Service. And pretty much it stayed on the course of the Internal Revenue Service, so I moved a little bit along the line very slowly learning more about the Internal Revenue Service until about 12 years later in 1993 when I went to Waco, Texas. Now, in Waco, we saw, prior to that, mostly tax people were involved in the Patriot community. 1993, we saw Waco, we saw the growth of the militia movement. There was a big bubble all at once. All these people joined the Patriot community. So if we look at the bubble as the width of the line as a consequence of the number of people involved, we have a little bulge here that's elongated, that's the tax people. And all of a sudden we got this big bubble comes in, that's the militia movement and the people disenchanted with what the government's activities in Waco, Texas. Well, we're still moving along, and some of those people in the militia movement did catch up with us, or nearly catch up with us, or maybe even passed us. But now this big bubble that came in began elongating too. Some people are still back at Waco, and others have moved along considerably. In 2007, 2008, the economic crisis, all of a sudden we get the Tea Party people, we get a bigger bubble hitting this thing. And they're coming in a big glob on this end, and they're slowly moving along this line. But all the time, people are either mentally dead or they continue slowly or rapidly moving along this line to the right. Now, the right, extreme right end of the line, let's call that restoration of constitutional government. As you move along that line, your commitment begins to change on what you're willing to do to achieve the goal. You keep going, it goes further, 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 further. It keeps growing. So that's the education you need. The Constitution, the abuses of government, all these elements come into play, but they are, yes, they're your education. Absent them, why would you move along that line at all? So yes, that education on the misdeeds of government, what the Constitution really means, a lot of philosophies come into play on this. And they're the education that is absolutely necessary. Now, the degree and involvement, that's dependent upon how far you've progressed along that line, as well as whether your progression is, let's say, on the more aggressive side or the more ministerial side. But yes, the education is necessary.
Now, is it acceptable to selectively target individuals in pursuit of our goal?
First, I wrote did an interview with a guy named John, a friend of mine back in the 90s, and it's called Popping Cops. Because back then, it was written as a consequence of the Monroe Federal Building bombing. He picked the federal building, and John suggested that he might have been better off to pick cops, because cops, and I've seen this, the cops are always there when the federal government's there. Most recent, Robert Beecher was arrested by the sheriff after he had been questioned by the FBI. The FBI said, we're not going to arrest you. The sheriff arrested him. Waco, the McClendon County Sheriff's Department of Waco PD provided border security, and the BATF and the FBI were inside that loop that was protected by local law enforcement. When Deerschout was arrested back in 96, 95, no, not, I'm sorry, 94, the police came in, SWAT team in Phoenix, Arizona, Sheriff Arpaio SWAT team came in, detained Deer and his wife and everybody, and then the FBI came in and stole his computer and all this stuff. In every instance, the police are the frontline troops, the cannon fodder for the federal government. I don't know of any case where there's been an entry, not just a visit, knock on the door and talk, which I've had happen a couple of times, but when there's an entry, an arrest to be made or anything, they always delegate the dirt work to the local law enforcement people. And the local law enforcement people, I have yet to see, defy the federal government in that regard. And a good example recently is Bundy Ranch. The sheriff stood down. He wasn't going to do anything to help the people. Maybe he said no to the feds, but absolutely he said no to his constituents. So he afforded no protection. So cops are a target. But then, again, back to the plan for restoration of constitutional government, there are other people that are targets. Recently, I put up a web page, a list of agents that were involved, and I'm going to have to get that link up, too, because I think it's very important to what we're talking about. There are people that can justifiably be targeted right now without question. We rely, and our Constitution relies on the concept of a trial by jury, except the people in government are never put on trial. The trial by jury, the purpose was, if there are a number of witnesses to an event, you hear all of them describe the event, because nobody has quite the same picture, quite the same view, quite the same perspective. And they might be lying too. So you hear a number of witnesses and determine from their testimony what the truth is. Well, you know, if there's a video camera recording both visual and sound of an event, and it's not cropped, but it has the whole thing from beginning to end, is it really necessary to have a jury to determine that this person killed that person? Are there other people that... have done things, say a judge that just rules against the people no matter what, contrary to the law. Is there any question that he's violated our Constitution? When it's extreme and there is no doubt, can that person be targeted? Well, that's what the plan suggests, that they can be targeted. The world has changed since 1775, but even then, in 1774, militia were taking their arms and going to courthouses and telling the judges, you had better resign or we will kill you. Never killed a judge. They all resigned. Now, in this day and age, if you wanted to tell a judge to resign, as soon as there was any inkling that that was going to happen, or even after you began, he'd call out and say, hey, they're coming here with guns. They want me to resign. And all of a sudden, the police force would be either in front of you with advance warning or behind you if he called after you arrived. So the world has changed. And with that changing world, we've got to look at what we still have a right to do, which is what they did. But if we're barred from doing that because the technology has changed things so that we can't do that, do we give up and say we can't do that, or do we find a different way to accomplish the same task? And if it's to remove a judge from office, he can either resign or get a serious and fatal case of lead poisoning. Either one has the effect. One is impossible for us to achieve, forces resignation. That leaves the only alternative to achieve a goal that was pursued by the founding fathers, and that's the removal of that judge from any role in the judiciary. So we follow the model. Are we more extreme? Yes, time warrants that extremity. But hey, not to worry. I think somebody did a count on unarmed people shot by police in this country since September 11th, 2001, 911, and had counted over 5,000 unarmed people have been killed by police. So it's not like we're doing something that's unheard of. They kill us with impunity. I don't know statistically how many of those shooters have ever been put on trial and what the consequences of the trial were, but I would say it's probably less than 10, just a guess. So the extreme is fair to us because it's fair to them. They're part of they're an extension of the judiciary. They're officers of the court in many cases. They enforce the edicts of the court. So what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander. So using that force rather than forcing retirement or resignation, their method has proven the viability of execution. And so that tool is open to us, and the targeting just has to be done. It's explained in the plan at great length, but targeting has to be done very discreetly, only the players involved. know who's targeted, and they make the determination themselves. They have to bear the moral and legal consequences. If they went beyond what was perceived later by a committee of safety jury, then they might be held accountable for it. But they make the decision, and were the consequences. But if they're careful, then there will be no consequences.
On that same line of thought, is there a moral issue with taking a life without it being self-defensive?
I remember the first time I shot, the only time in my life that I've shot a human being and saw him be hit. I didn't kill him, but he died within a minute or so. Was there a moral consequence? No, I'd hardened myself already to my job is to kill these people, the Vietnamese, that are in opposition to us. I've explained the process, the mental process I went through in preparing myself for that role in an article called Liberty or Laws, and jealously guard our liberties. That I don't think it's easy if you're not prepared. I don't know, because I've not been there. But the thought of taking another human life, I think, is to somebody with good values, is reprehensible. But sometimes the reprehensible becomes necessity. But you have to be prepared to do it. You can't just do it like a lot of these thugs do. They say, hey, do it. They do it, and they get off on it and go do it again. Good people don't treat it that way. Some soldiers get caught up in, I think, a remorse or a guilt, and then they just get vindictive and start killing everything around, not the Americans, but the Vietnamese. And it happened many times in Vietnam. I think it's happened a few times in Iraq and Afghanistan. They broke down morally and were repulsed by their own actions. So advanced preparation probably forestalls, at least, the consequences that might impose themselves mentally on you or morally on you if you don't prepare for it, which is why I wrote that article I mentioned.
So how does one take the initiative in restoring constitutional government?
How does one take the initiative in restoring constitutional government? Now we're getting into the good stuff. A little background on the plan for restoration of constitutional government. I've seen for 20 years plans to get back to where we're supposed to be. Let's call it this constitutional government, just so we know where we're going, because I think that's where everybody wants to go. But I've seen so many plans, and oh, there's three steps. You got to do this, that. You got to elect these guys to office. Got to elect these guys out. There are so many plans out there. There's a page that I can't think of the name of the page now that purports to have the plan, and it's got three steps, and it's got a couple paragraphs on each step. But some friends of mine who have read the plan, upon their completion of reading it, when they said there are plans before they read it, they said afterwards there is only one plan. It's a very thorough plan. It goes into almost every detail, at least conceptually. It's many pages, it's a lot to read. It's also available in audio format in a series of podcasts, but it's a plan that will take some of the things we've talked about, as I've mentioned them, the plan during the course of what we've discussed so far, and shows how they can be applied. But to take the initiative, the plan is overall a very broad strategy, that plan, but there are some other lower strategies that need to be concerned with, and I address some of them. When we were talking about hearts and mind, keeping food, the water, the electricity, even employment. But so we're going to go through some things that have to have their own unique strategies. One is supplies. Where are the supplies going to come from? The Patriot community, the smaller stuff that we need for day-to-day lives and all that. Well, that's going to come if the constitutional forces assure that the hardware store is supplied with hammers and nails and screws and things we need to continue working, and that the militia units and the committees of safety have what they need to function, and the people in their homes have what they need to function. Then we get to equipment. Now, equipment, supplies basically are expendable or small tools, things like that. Equipment, vehicles, new vehicles, armament. armament. Some of the armament that we might benefit from is, let's say, well, let's go back to supplies for a minute. Food is an interesting one. Most people don't realize that in or near every community there are grocery warehouses. I worked in one many years ago up in Pennsylvania, and it covered a fairly broad area, maybe a radius of 15 or 20 miles, a lot of little towns, little stores. It was an independent supplier. Where I live now, there's a Walmart shipping center, or not shipping center, warehouse, about 15 miles from me. I don't know if they have food in there or not, but some of them have food because Walmart sells food now, especially in the smaller stores, but especially in the super centers. They're larger than some grocery stores in what they provide. So those warehouses that store these goods are ready sources for supplies that we might need. Less frequent are hardware or other products that we might need. Paper products are in the grocery stores, toilet paper, Kleenex, paper towels, things like that. Toilet paper, don't want to run out of toilet paper. But hardware stores, or somewhere there will be a hardware supply distribution center. A lot of stuff's drop shipped, so there might be a manufacturer in your area that makes something that that you need. Equipment, larger things, especially military supplies, and I'm going to dwell on that. There are a lot of places where military supplies are available. National Guard armories, police departments, sheriff's departments, the 1033 program with the MRAPs and bayonets and full automatic rifles and body armor and all these other things. That's a supply depot for us if we find out who's got the keys, where they store the stuff, get them on our side, or take the keys by force. But we can own that equipment. Gun stores, camping stores have a lot of equipment that's necessary for militia or military type operations. So this stuff is available to us. I mean, people are going out and spending thousands of dollars when, and true, they've got it in hand now, and it's not if there's one available, which is the circumstance when you rely on what I'm talking about. Shelter, another thing. Camping stores, you can find a lot of shelter things. There are a lot of places that make manufactured homes or mobile homes, and hey, those are supplies. You can live in a manufactured home, a mobile home. When I was on the Indian Reservation in Connecticut, I lived in what's called a construction trailer. It had about 40 feet long. It was kind of fifth wheel trailer, you know, the back end of a semi. There was about 12 feet of office. That was where I lived. The Indians stored their supplies in the back part of that. In fact, I didn't even want to deal with it, so they went in the lift door in the back, and I just put stuff in front of the door that came through to the office. But I had a counter at the end and sleeping bag on the floor, or I guess a mattress and sheets on the floor, and was quite comfortable. But that backside would, and the front side together, that trailer would probably sleep 30 or 40 people and keep them warm if you had some means of, and there are a number of means to, creative means, preppers could tell you, of providing for in that shelter. There's also digging caves, a lot of ways to provide shelter absent readily available, but the advantage of the plan is you stay in place in your community. You live at home. Other people live in their homes, so there's very little need for shelter unless you're on a mission or something, or for somehow your home was destroyed. Financing, oh, there's a good one, and I think I alluded to that before, but if things happen, if the plan is implemented and we begin restoring constitutional government, at least for the time being, if you want to buy bread, you'll be buying bread with Federal Reserve notes, dollars. Well, there's banks full of them. There's stores full of them. There's, you know, they're around. Now, we go back to a concept that existed back in our Revolutionary War period. you leave a receipt for something. If you go in the bank and take $50,000 in cash so that you can purchase National Guard stuff we own already, we paid for it, but if rifles and ammunition out of a gun store or tents or things like that, you don't have to. You can pay them if you got the cash. You might need the cash, however, for the local community to pay somebody that was on welfare to sweep the streets and clean up messes or paint buildings or something like that. Give them busy work. Make sure they've got money to buy food and you know, take care of their necessities. And that cash in the bank might serve well in that purpose. But as you take things like guns or ammunition from a gun shop, for example, give the owner of the gun shop a signed receipt of what you've taken. You don't need to put a price on it. That can be resolved later. But he knows then, like Washington's foragers did, they left receipts. In this day and age, if you're not securely in a white area, you might not want to put your name on it. And it's best for you to retain a copy and give him a copy, but put some symbol that's unique, your X, so to speak, a unique symbol that indicates it's you, and put it on both receipts and have him sign at least your receipt to acknowledge that he received a receipt. So you're dealing above board and honestly with these people and those things we've talked about. And these are strategies. How do we make sure these things flow, that the supplies are available to the public as well as us, equipment's available to the public as well as us, food's available to the public as well as us, shelter's available to the public as well as us, financing's available to us as well as them, because we're going to be distributing that financing back to them so they can go down to the grocery store and buy groceries. There's one other strategy that we're going to talk about, and this is the one that becomes very important and is addressed in the plan in parts 1 and 2, and it's called aggravation. The founders aggravated the hell out of the British, whether it was the Boston Tea Party, the heckling that was going on at the Boston Massacre, the invasion of Fort William and Mary, and the theft of the cannon and powder and shot and ball and all that stuff, and other events where we stole things back from the British that were ours because our taxes paid for them. They belonged to the colony. The British assumed ownership. We assumed ownership, and we prevailed in many cases. But these were acts of aggravation. The governor of Virginia got really pissed off when he took both the colony's powder and the public powder, and there were two in this one arsenal, when they demanded them back, and he ended up paying. He didn't give them the powder back, but he gave them the value of that powder in specie, in money. But then he decided, from now on, I'm going to live on that ship out in the harbor. So acts of aggravation. The biggest act of aggravation was a guy named Captain Parker and 70 or 80 some men who stood with him defiantly, not disobediently, but defiantly against over 1,000 men. That was definitely an act of aggravation, and that was what kicked it off. Now, we've been aggravated for a long time, whether it be Donald Scott in California, who was shot in his own home because the sheriff's department claimed there was marijuana growing on his ranch, and they didn't even find a marijuana seed. Then we've got Sammy and Vicky Weaver being killed by the government at Ruby Ridge. Then we've got 80-some people dying in Waco, Texas, murdered by the federal government. We've got Gordon Call, who was executed in a cabin in I forget what state. We've got all these people shot by police. We've been aggravated to death. And maybe it's time to aggravate back. Well, aggravation encourage the government to get more drastic? Damn right it will. That's exactly how it happened last time. But we've got to get to that flashpoint. And that flashpoint is a scenario, the objective or the element of which is unknown at this point. That point in time where there's a standoff. And after that point, the world has changed and we have begun actively and aggressively pursuing constitutional restoration of constitutional government. Now, April 12, 2014 was a turning point. Don't mistake me. It wasn't a flashpoint. Had it turned to gunfire, it would have been a flashpoint, and the game would be on. But instead, through whatever cause, divine intervention, whatever it was, divine guidance, whatever it was, no shots were fired, but the defiance against the federal government was overwhelming, both physically and psychologically. And we still, months later, have the psychological high ground over those events. But they're not the flashpoint. The flashpoint is something that was pursued. On the morning of April 19th, as John Hancock and Sam Adams left Concord for Woburn because the British were already in Lexington, history reports that Sam Adams told John Hancock, what a wonderful day. He didn't mean the weather, because after all the pushing and prodding that had gone on for really as far as 15 years back, finally the flashpoint came. To Sam Adams, that was a beautiful day. A glorious day, that was it. Oh, what a glorious day. The glorious day was not the weather. It was not the sky. It was the fact that the flashpoint had been achieved, and now we've begun the process. And this is before Concord. Now we have begun the process of displacing the government that has imposed itself contrary to the British Constitution on the people of these colonies. That flashpoint is not going to come if we sit passively. It's not going to come if we continue to waste our time voting and losing no matter who we elect. It's not going to come if we just yell out in alternate media, this is wrong, this should not be done. In fact, every time we delay pursuing that flashpoint, we give advantage to them. Now we've got Muslims and Mexicans flowing into this country in invasive numbers. Millions of them have come into this country. We've got diseases, the endovirus 68 and Ebola, coming into this country. And we sit idly by? So we've got an invasion going on. Man, it's crazy. So aggravation, let's look at some. One is monkey wrenching, and this is what a friend taught me, and I'm not real versed in this, but monkey wrenching. The guerrilla warfare tactic of sabotaging only government property without causing injury to any humans. Now, let's look at that. I guess we could blow up the Murrah building again. Oh, no, they didn't rebuild it. And make sure nobody, or maybe night watchmen, were inside. But Tim McVeigh, and I agree with what he did, but I disagree with his tactic. Let me make that clear. I agree with what Tim McVeigh did. He attacked a federal United States government building. The tactic I don't agree with is he did it in the daytime when so many people were inside. But he felt it was necessary, and if you go to McVeigh's forum at outpostoffreedom.com, or if you just put McVeigh's forum in Google, you'll end up at McVeigh's forum. I don't think anybody else has used the phrase. And you'll see that he justifies, he's written a couple of articles there that justify his action, at least in his mind. And I can't disagree with it, but it was a little extreme in my thought process, but I still support Tim McVeigh. He was the first soldier of the second, American soldier of the second American Revolution, or Restoration. But those acts of aggravation are to piss the government off, so they take that stupid step of going to Lexington. Cops, we mentioned popping cops, the article from the 90s. Cops that have murdered people, there's no excuse for these guys to continue popping those cops, and perhaps others. I mentioned judges that just say, screw the Constitution, we're going to make the law the way we want the law to be. How about Mexicans crossing the border? Mexicans crossing the border with arms? Shoot them. When they fall down, the rifle falls to the ground. Anybody that goes to pick up the rifle, shoot them. A guy comes across the border with tattoos, more tattoos than he's got clothes on, shoot him. He's not a good guy. Believe me, if he's got that many tattoos coming north across the southern border, he's not a good guy. Might make a mistake, but chances are he's not a good guy. How about Muslims? These guys that... I just wrote an article about whether Muslims could fit within our society, and no, they can't, because they bring Sharia law with them. But the article I wrote was based on a video that was done in Scandinavia. And these people admitted that all the punishments in the Quran are correct. And they also admitted that they're not extremists. So I guess the difference between a moderate Muslim and an extreme Muslim is the extreme Muslim already has a knife in his hand, where the moderate Muslim hasn't yet picked up the knife. So Muslims are targets. Curiously, when you see the burqa and all these rags on somebody, is it a male or a female? A number of Muslims have been caught disguising themselves as women. With their clothing, it's quite easy. Our standard in this society is everybody has a face. In fact, I saw a good meme the other day. It showed an oval cut for the eyes and the burqa, but that oval cut was put over the eyes of an American woman, blinding her. We're not seeing in proper perspective how destructive the Muslim influence in this country is. As they take over and make the majority of voters in a community, they are going to change the laws within that community. So reduction of their population is an aggravation, but it's necessary for the preservation of our way of life. So those with the moral fortitude to be prepared to begin the battle, there are some targets of aggravation for you. Now, tactics. We're going to go into some ideas about what you can do from a tactical standpoint to afford greater protection for you in conducting any activity that you choose to pursue. First, we'll talk about both traffic and other cameras. There are traffic cameras. There are government cameras on government buildings, and there are private security cameras. Especially the traffic cameras, which are often fitted with the license plate identification capability. They're not face recognition. Face recognition could be adapted to them, but they can read license plates. So if you drive through a series of streets, they can track you everywhere you drove within camera range. They probably have facial recognition capabilities. The government building cameras are probably equally well equipped. Most of them, at least the traffic cams, are now radio wave rather than wired. But the government building ones generally, I think, are wired. They may be radio as well. The private security cameras most often are wired, though they can be radio as well. The important ones are most important are the traffic cams. You don't have to go near a government building, and that includes police stations, Social Security office, any government building. They're going to have cameras out there nowadays. I don't know. Somebody said there's an estimate of 280 million cameras going in this country right now. I don't know if he was right or not. That seems a little high to me, but it could be true. They're all over. Traffic cameras, though, can track your movements, and those are the ones that are most concerned. Even though they're stationary, they're tied together. So get a map of your community and as far as you might want to go, and start marking on that map where the cameras are. If they're fixed direction, indicate the direction. If they're by putting a fan out in the direction that they're pointing. If they're articulating, draw a circle around them so that you know. Talk to technical people. Is there a way to take these out? Now, a friend of mine years ago said that he's in Indiana, and I haven't talked to him in years. He said that he felt that he could develop a little laser gun that would, if not destroy the camera, at least, just like when you get a flash of light at night, you can't see until you get your night vision back, that apparently some cameras at least operate on in that aspect. So if he flashed a laser at them, it would at least cut them for a while. A good shot with a paint gun could color the lens, obliterate the lens. A .22 rifle might take the lens out. A shotgun with small pellets might take the lens out. But at any rate, you've got to defeat the camera. So know where they are, public and private, to the extent that you can. But private's always a backup to government. If the cameras are there and you want to use them to your advantage, let's just say that you're going to go east to conduct a mission. Well, what you do then is you drive through town going west, making sure that you go in the view of the traffic cameras. And after you leave town and you've mapped the cameras, you circle around town again, avoiding the cameras, and the government has absolute proof that you went west. Well, you went east. But remember, all the way, wherever you go, you've got to decoy that. Now, how can you decoy the vehicle when you're traveling like that? Well, get some water-based paint, and if you've got a white pickup truck, make it a black pickup truck and hope to heck it don't rain. There are some acrylics that you can, if you treat your car with silicone, just spray silicone on it. A lot of acrylics you could paint your car with acrylics would not be susceptible to the rain once they dried, but would peel off because you've got the silicone underneath. Little messier cleanup, but make it a different color. Go to a junkyard, find an old license plate, slap it, clean it up, slap it on the back of the truck. Magnet, bands, screws, doesn't matter how you do it. Make it somebody else's truck. The fact that the license plate is no longer issued is inconsequential because they're going to be tracking the truck with that license plate where they tracked your truck going the other way. And yours is now a different color. Quick change. And it's not you going east. You went west, and then you just disappeared out of sight. When you come back, after you clean the truck off and take the license plates off, you can go back around to the west side and come back into town, and you've proven absolutely to these technological geniuses that you were always west of town and you never went east. That distraction has effectively protected you from while carrying out a mission. Another distraction, cell phones. Very few cell phones now do not have GPS in them. Well, you can turn it off so that it doesn't imprint on your pictures. You can turn it off so no software can pick it up except 911 and the government. So again, when I'm going west in my truck, I find somebody that's going further west, and I take my cell phone and put it in the back of their truck or tape it to their car, or if it's a bus, put it on the bus back under a seat in the back of the bus or somewhere where it won't be found. Now I've got both my car and my cell phone going west, and damn, the government will swear on the stand that you did not go east because they've got video and they've got tracking your cell phone going west. Now this brings us to cell phones. Very important to get what's called a drop phone. These are the ones that you can have a fixed amount of time or that you can keep adding time to, but you don't have to affix a name to them. I think T-Mobile still has them. There's a lot of smaller companies breaking into the industry, and I know T-Mobile started that way. So there are companies around. You buy one of these phones. But with it, when you've got it, you never call a phone number that you ever called from your cell phone because they have this networking algorithm. And if you look at the documents that Snowden released, I don't remember the name of the program, but everybody you call shows up around you. Now, your friend Joe over here, everybody he calls shows up on him, including you, and including anybody that he called and you called. So they show the strength of the connection between you and Joe and other people that both of you know. They start developing strength patterns based upon that and have a good idea who you call. So the first time you call anybody that you've ever called before, you have begun to tie yourself into that mesh, that network that they've already developed on you. This is what they're doing with the stuff up in Nevada at the NSA storage facility. They can't listen to the calls, or so they say, but they can log the calls. So if I called a number that was on my network or Joe's network, hey, there's one string. Hey, that could be a mistake. But say I called somebody on my network, and then I called somebody that I'd never called before that's on Joe's network. Ah, now they're starting to get a fix. They're starting to be able to logically assume that I called somebody that was on my network and somebody was on Joe's network. So somewhere in this big network, I know Joe, or at least somebody on Joe's network, and I know somebody on my network. The third one starts to pinpoint it even further. A fourth one, they might tie down to you absolutely because you're the only one that knew all these numbers. So everybody else has to have a drop phone as well, and you have to have their numbers. Now, the fact that you create a totally independent network by calling people in the drop phone network, they don't know who the drop phone network is. So you've defeated their ability to identify your relationship to these networks by going to a drop phone, so long as you never compromise the drop phone network. Very important. Facial imaging, we mentioned that earlier. There are a number of sites on the internet that will assist you in it, but basically facial character recognition has a number of identifiable points: your chin, the outside of your lips, the upper and lower of your lips, the point of your nose, the bottom edges of your nose, the bridge of your nose, your eyes, your eyebrows, your ears, your forehead. They have points. And what they do to recognize, in a way, it's like fingerprinting, but it's mathematically. Fingerprinting is not mathematical. This is mathematical. There's a relationship, a distance relationship between all these elements on your face. Online look up facial character recognition or defeating facial character recognition, and you'll see where these points of identification are. So if I go in and I change some of those points, if I extend my eyelashes and use an eyebrow pencil to extend the corners of my eyes, and I lower the bridge on my nose, and with the little darkening, I make it look like the outside edges of my nose are wider than they are, or maybe even narrower than they are by darkening the little rounded tips. If I can make my lips look larger and my mouth look wider, I begin to change my numbers. And it's like an internet email address. It's absolute. And if it doesn't meet the absolute, it might get some probabilities, get them close. But if you've distorted enough of the features, you've thrown them off completely. Having a mole high up on your right cheek, for example, might move your eye in the facial character recognition. Having a hat that throws a shadow on your face will work as long as the camera doesn't have the capability of being enhanced light-wise. But you can defeat facial character recognition. A good beard with a mustache will distort the entire lower portion of your face. So an actor's beard can be a very effective tool. Obscuring your ears is another one, because ears are points on this. So learn how to, if you live in a city especially, learn how you can walk down the street and not be you. Now, there's a guy that I ran across something. He sells a face mask. It's rather expensive, but it's him. And so he's had people test it, and other people would put on this mask, walk down the street. Somebody would use their camera with the facial recognition software, and it would come back to him. So he's everywhere. He's like that guy with the white mask in V. Everybody looks the same with that mask on. That's how, and we're back to technology, because now we've got cameras all over the city saying, Joe Blow's here, he's there, he's there, he's there, if you use this guy's mask. But on the other hand, they don't see Joe Blow there because you've changed your face enough to make it look like somebody else. It may coincidentally match somebody. If not, it may be close enough to match dozens or hundreds of people. as far as the mathematics. We've talked about cell phone diversion and driving with the camera's diversion. There's one other one that we practiced in Waco, and that's if you use a cell phone, if they have an active tap on you, which we felt they had on me at Waco, if you've got a copper wired phone like I do, or if you've got a cell phone and they're monitoring that, they listen to what you say. They assume that you're not listening. I'm sorry, you don't know that they're listening, and you just go on carrying on a conversation. I'll give you an idea of what we did back then. We had worked out via mail with some pay telephones. And so, you know, I was talking to a guy up in Washington, and I said, well, call me at B. And so I went to the B phone, and he went to a pay phone and called me at B phone. And so we had a conversation that there's no way the government knew who we were. It were two pay phones. We just happened to be in the same cities that we were in. And they have no idea that that's the case. So pre-plan with other people where a payphone is, if you can still use them. But, you know, payphones, a lot of them now you can't call into. So even though that worked back in the 90s, I don't know that it would work now. But one of the conversations I had on the phone in the motel was, let's see, I'm going to Denver tomorrow. I've canceled my flight. I'm going to cancel my flight to Florida because I've got to talk to some people in Denver. Now, the concern was that whether, because of what I'd done in Waco, that I was going to be arrested when I got away from there. So they could arrest me at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport or when I landed at Orlando or at Denver. So since I was from Orlando, I said I'm canceling the flight and I'm going to Denver to meet some people. The Denver flight was, I think, 2 hours after the Orlando flight, but I said, later on in a conversation with somebody else, I said, well, I'm still going to get up early tomorrow and get up to the airport and get a good meal before I get on the plane. I'm kind of exhausted. So I had reason. I had created a reason to be up at the airport earlier for the Orlando flight, but still saying that I'm going to Denver. And so I got on the Orlando flight. I hadn't canceled the Orlando flight. And back then, I don't know how it is now because I don't fly anymore, but I could have gotten a ticket to Denver at the counter. And since I'd been dealing with cash, I couldn't do it with the credit card, so I had to do it at the counter. So anyway, the diversion was to make them think I was going where I wasn't going. And you know, you got to think of things like this. If you say something on the phone and act like you don't know that they're listening, they're going to accept prima facie what you said. So you make your arrangements elsewhere by other means if you're going to do something. We talked about throwaway phones. Now, there's some other things. The MRAPs and the Bearcats and all these vehicles the government's giving to people. All this military equipment, believe it or not, has vulnerabilities. It might be mine-proof. But, for example, the MRAPs have large cylinders on above the axle of both front and rear axles, and it's a kind of reservoir for the brake system. If the brake system goes out, somehow you've got the secondary system that'll still operate. However, that secondary system is vulnerable because even an AK-47 round at a fairly close range will penetrate 316 steel. I've done it. Probably about 30 feet. So, and I doubt that cylinder is that thick. But find the vulnerability of the equipment, and a lot of the information is available online. If you disable the MRAP, the guys are stuck there. And if you want them to get out, quite simply turn on the oven. Start heating it up. And they'll come out. And if they're coming out exposed out of a hatch, they're pretty vulnerable. And so it's easier to get them to give up, arrest them, incarcerate them, take their weapons, and maybe even put the MRAP back into service. Decoys. I've talked with people on the desert about if they did go down and shoot the Mexicans came over the border with guns, a couple things necessary. If you've got a militia camp, you want a tarp up, a shade tarp in the middle of the camp and people going in and out of it, especially when an operation is going to go off. So you've got everybody in, say, light-colored clothes. Now, three guys put on dark jackets or dark shirts, and they take off to go on a mission. They find, set up a canopy or a tent, but a canopy is better. And so when they go out on the mission, these guys will go under the canopy. They'll put on dark shirts. Everybody should have a hat on, cap or something. But they'll put on dark shirts, and they'll take off and go down a ways, and however long it takes to wait until somebody crosses the border with a rifle in hand or way too many tattoos. And then you shoot the son of a bitches. Now, the thing with drones, and this is adaption to technology, the thing with drones, the drones can track you. They can get your heat signature. They can get you visually and all that. They're not going to start shooting at you. So then you've got to go back and go under that shelter with other people coming and going and change hats and go back to camo. And just stash those clothes. Doesn't matter where you stash them. If they find them, they're not going to know who wore them without some pretty extensive forensic work. So that means that they cannot identify where the guys that shot these guys went after they went under this canopy, a tent or a shade roof, blue tarp, anything. So we've gotten rid of the trackability on that. Now there's one thing that remains that might be problematic, and that's called the rifling on the weapon. Now, there's two ways to deal with that. If I've got two AR-15s, one of them I don't have, and I secrete it somewhere, make sure that the drone won't see it. You know, if I can conveniently do it just walking under a tree somewhere and quickly drop my day rifle in the down and pick up this night rifle and then continue on down the road almost nonstop, and I go to the position, we go to the position, and we shoot some guys with a lot of tattoos and or rifles, and then we go back and we place the night rifles back in their secure place, and see, this could actually be done later. I mean, I'm saying on the way, but as long as the feds ain't on the ground there, you can secrete the other one. And a good way to do it would be like a wooden box underground that you could just push off 3 or 4 inches of dirt, open the lid, put your day rifle and pick your night rifle up, close the lid, cover it back up. However you can safely secrete that gun, maybe tape it under your vehicle or suspend it on wires tightly under your vehicle, whatever you can do. And what you're doing then is you're taking away the means for them to do ballistics on the bullets that entered the tattoos or the guy that had the rifle and tie them to anybody in the camp. Nobody there. No, none of us did it. Nope, you're looking in the wrong direction. There is one other way that I've not tested yet, but I think it would work. Emery paper's wonderful stuff. It's very hard, but it's very fine, meaning it's a strong sandpaper. But it's very fine. So if I did use this rifle to shoot somebody and I wanted to change the ballistics on it, the ballistic footprint on it, if I took the brush for cleaning my rifle and wrapped the emery paper around it and ran it down the barrel 4 or 5 times, I think I could appreciably change the rifling characteristics that would be necessary to prove that this gun fired that shot. So those are the types of things that can be done. And you know, these are just my thoughts. Be creative. I mean, they're giving you an idea. You can defeat all kinds of things the government does by knowing what they're doing and doing the unexpected, doing something that they didn't expect to deflect any attention towards you. So, got any questions or anything, or have we pretty much
I think you've pretty much covered it, and it's quite a bit of food for thought you've really kind of offered me tonight. And I think what it really does suggest, really more, not suggest, clearly states, is that there are really no excuses anymore. I mean, I think really this is basically the best comprehensive argument, and also some points of action to take in terms of restoring constitutional government.
Well, that does take us one more place. History will recognize Captain Parker and those people that stood on Lexington Green. History will recognize Tim McVeigh. History will recognize Ryan Payne. There are other people out there now who I'm sure would like to have a place in history, and I'm sure that they'd like to see constitutional government restored. If they have the fortitude, both moral and physical, to begin acts of aggravation, they will be recognized for the role they played bringing us to the flashpoint that is absolutely necessary. There is no restoration of constitutional government unless you believe in the vote. There is no possible means of restoration of constitutional government absent the flashpoint. The flashpoint has occurred in every revolution or restoration in history. Something happens that forces hostility, creates in a sense a war. Not in the traditional sense necessarily, but there's that flashpoint. In Russia, during both the 1918 revolution and the one that ended up in the splitting up the Soviet Union, there were flashpoints. Sometimes they can be peaceful. There's an acquiescence because the military apparently sided with the people in the breakup of the Soviet Union, and there was very, very little loss of life. It was almost impossible to find any loss of life. But the flashpoint was when the tanks were sent on the people, and then the tanks decided not to do anything. So that flashpoint is the point of no return. Now we must decide what form of government we will have. Before then, you can hope, you can pray, but you ain't going nowhere until you reach that flashpoint. And then it's a must, because one or the other will prevail. So those who want their history to record their purpose in life, that are young enough and smart enough, it's up to you to get us to the flashpoint and get the game on.
Well, I'll definitely take that to heart. So, well, thank you for talking with me about this, Gary. It's definitely something that's weighed on my mind because, I mean, I used to be one of those people who actually sincerely believed in peacefully evolving beyond statism. But the more I look around, the more I talk to folks, and the more that I do, I've basically come to the point where I understand that there is no peaceful solution. And that's where I'm at.
Well, I'm glad you finally got there. And let's hope a few other people move along that other not-so-thin line as rapidly as you have. Well, it's been a pleasure, Sleepy. And with that, I'll say good night.
All right. Good night.